All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Glad you could join us today. When Senator Josh Hawley described what he called an attack on men and masculinity in a speech to the National Conservatism Conference a few weeks ago, it raised the question of whether or not masculinity can be defined. Certainly, there are societal traditions, norms, and expectations, but are those what he's defending? Knowing how to be a man is increasingly vexing. Even the American Psychiatric Association is concerned. In 2019, for the first time ever, they released new guidelines for therapists who work with men and boys. Musician Brett Newsky understands the confusion about being a man in the midst of his storied career playing with every 90s band you could ever really think of. He's written a book called It's Hard to Be a Person: Defeating Anxiety, Surviving the World, and Having More Fun. It's about his struggle with anxiety, as well as his struggle with asking for help. The topic of mental health also animates his music. Listen to a bit of his newest song. It's called Seeking Asylum from Myself.
Inside a cabinet, you're Jimmy in the lock-in. Won't you break up a key in my left brain? Please, I'm absorbing too much energy from people in the room. Wanna catch appeals, but the doctor gave me pills. Barometer is in me under chemical sway.
Brett Newsky found some healing in the creative process and in reaching out to other men. He's performing at the 7th Street Entry at First Avenue in Minneapolis tomorrow night. But first, he joins me today. Good morning to you, Brett. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Angela. Thanks for hosting me.
Sure. Also with us today, Brett, are two therapists who work with men on their mental health. We have Anesh Patel on the line. Anesh is a therapist in St. Paul. Hello, Anesh.
Hey, Angela.
Good
Great
morning.
To be on.
Sure. Also, Jacob Shookman Falk is with us, and Jacob is a therapist in Edina. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Angela. Thanks for having me.
Good morning to you. And I want to hear from our listeners, too. Are you a man who has struggled with your mental health? Did you get some help or find some type of healing in a creative pursuit? Do you live with or love a man with a mental health struggle? Call us. Have you helped him with his healing and how? The number is 651-227-6000. Or you can call us at 800-242-2828. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Brett, I'll start with you. How did you realize that anxiety was an issue for you? I mean, what did it look like in your behavior? What did it look like in your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think, as a young person, as a kid, as a young adult, you kind of go through life having no idea what anxiety is. I know I didn't have any idea why I was kind of like a little bit paranoid a lot of the time, or just kind of uneasy, or, you know, someone like wouldn't respond to my email and I'd be like, oh my God, they hate me. What have I done? So I think, you know, in my late 20s, I finally got diagnosed with it, which was like kind of a huge relief. I was like, all right, this is like an actual thing, like this underwater feeling, or like these like brief moments of existential dread where you kind of stop seeing in color and you're like, oh my gosh, everything is not going to work out very well. And once you kind of figure out that that's like a pretty normal condition, especially in America, it's like, it's kind of a relief, you know?
You said diagnosis. So at some point, you made the decision, or someone encouraged you to go see a doctor.
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of interesting because I was having these like crippling acid reflux attacks because I'm a singer, you know, that's how I make my living. Mm-hmm. You know, we tour in like an alternative indie rock band around the country. And it was just like I was having these acid reflux like attacks, and I was losing my voice, and just like it was kind of controlling my world. I was panicking about it all the time, and I went to all these like gastrointestinal doctors, regular medical doctors, and like the only advice they ever gave me was just like, yeah, just double your medication. All right, just triple your like acid blocker medication. And then I went to an ENT, you know, like 3-4 years in, and he's like, Newski, you're just like, you're really having like panic attacks. You got to treat your anxiety first. And he put me on like a low dose of like a citalopram or something. And that like cured all my tummy acid reflux problems overnight. So it was all, it's just crazy like what your brain can trigger in your body, and your, just like your heart attacks you, your brain can attack you too. And it can make like these physical ailments actually happen to you. It's wild.
Brett, that's a very vivid description. Thank you for that. And I'm imagining people are listening and they may hear something there that they are seeing in their own lives. Anesh, as he describes the ways that anxiety showed up in his life, what can you tell us about like what you've seen, what your training has shown you about ways anxiety can show up in men?
I think that's spot on for kind of the symptoms of anxiety, but there's just so many dimensions. There's context, there's, you know, racism, there's colonization, there's so many factors that impact somebody's ability to feel safe in their body, in the world.
And Jacob, what about you? How would you describe the ways that anxiety can show up, how it can shape behavior and thoughts and feelings?
Well, I think that anxiety, kind of as Brett said, sort of is actually very normal and even in some ways part of the human condition. I don't think that everyone knows it. And, you know, there that, you know, in other doctors, and there can be sort of the GI issues or attributed to other things. And it is interesting because anxiety we tend to think of as something that's just in the brain or the mind, or we believe in the split. And it's not that that's not useful, but that, you know, anxiety, stress, it's really, I guess, sometimes what they refer to as a neurophysiological experience. So it is in the body, it is in the mind and brain. And I think that, you know, Brett's experience with that, I think, actually is spot on, and I think really illuminating about anxiety and important to remember.
And that's just interesting. You said that racism can impact anxiety, too. Tell me more about that and how that can show up in the body and in behavior.
Well, you know, I'm a person of color. I work with a lot of people of color. And I think just believing them and their experiences and not feeling safe all the time in the world, and I don't know how much you want to divert this show in that direction, but I would just say that's an important part of, do you feel safe? Do you trust the people around you to take care of you, to have your back?
And so, Brett, was it hard for you to ask for help? I mean, you're having maybe the medical part of it, the acid reflux part of it, like, oh, I should go see a doctor. But the other part of it, the feeling like you described it as underwater and feeling paranoid. Was that hard for you to say, like, I can't figure this out on my own. I need some help.
Oh, good question. I mean, you know, like you all, it's like I grew up in the Midwest, you know, and there is certainly that like, you know, be tough, don't be soft kind of mentality, like hard work hard kind of blue collar ethos that I grew up around, which I think is honestly very useful. And that's honestly helped me a lot in like the music industry where doors are just slamming in your face just every day. So I don't.
Literally slamming your face, or just opportunities?
Yeah, I think metaphorically, but but there's always more doors to be opened. And I think just having that, like, you know, you get knocked down, you get up again, not to quote Chumbawamba, that was unintentional, but it's helped me kind of keep going in the music industry. That said, I think there, you know, being a, like a hypersensitive kid growing up in that environment, I think it was just hard to kind of, talk about deeper stuff or deeper mental wobbles. And I think, you know how that goes. You bottle that stuff up and that just builds up over time and kind of makes you feel lousy to not have that vent or, you know, to like want to like cry your eyeballs out and just like just bottle it up for years or whatever, you know?
And Brett, how old are you now?
I'm 34.
And you said you had your anxiety diagnosis that happened when you were in your late 20s?
I think like 26, 27, maybe.
And so what was going on in your teenage years, or when did you first, you know, at what age did you start? Do you now look back and reflect like I was having anxiety issues much earlier?
Well, I can think back to like fourth and fifth grade, even as like a tiny kid. Like I would be like in my bed, like about to go to sleep, and then I would have a panic, like, oh, did I put that homework assignment in my backpack? And then I would run downstairs in the middle of the night, wake myself up from a deep slumber, and check my backpack to make sure I like finished my homework so I didn't get like a B or a B minus or something. So like little ticks like that, and just kind of like, yeah, just often being like paranoid, people were like ticked off at me and that kind of feeling. So, you know, I had a sweet childhood. My parents were really rad people and stuff. I think I just like really kind of struggled to connect with people. And, you know, I grew up in New Berlin, Wisconsin, just outside of Milwaukee, which is, it's not really known as like an arts friendly, like creative place. It's kind of a, you know, no disrespect, it's a nice place to grow up and all, but it is a bit of a cultural wasteland, and there's not much much happening in that arena. So I think it was just like kind of a strange place to be kind of a arty farty creative kid, you know?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about mental health, and mental health for men in particular, the men's issues that therapists talk to them about. Are you a man who has struggled with your mental health? Did you get some help or find some healing in a creative pursuit? Do you live with or love a man with a mental health struggle? We're taking your phone calls as we talk with two therapists. Have you been able to help someone who you love with healing? How? Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Jacob is asking for help an issue for men in particular? I mean, many of us have problems asking for help, but when we look at mental health, do you find that men in particular have a hard time reaching out for help?
Yes, I definitely have seen that with, at least in the scope of my practice. I know it's somewhat of a stereotype, and it certainly does not hold true for everybody. But yes, asking for help or even recognizing that maybe they are having certain feelings or experiences, maybe kind of as he had just referred to, there is sort of this culture, not just from kind of what it means to be a man, but sort of Midwestern culture, the Minnesota Nice. It can come from parents who just either also don't talk about feelings, but in some ways it's kind of like discouraged. And yeah, seen kind of as weak or, you know, some variation of that. So I have seen a lot of men that struggled initially, but something happened enough in their life where eventually, if they are seeing me, that led them to it, a prompt, a negative experience. But often I do hear it come from essentially inevitably shame. They've tried to do anything and everything else to try to cope with it, to understand themselves. And just eventually people, like, I think usually don't actually come to therapy unless it's, you know, they've tried anything and everything else that they can, which I think is normal and healthy to do. So.
And Anesh, in your work as a therapist, have you seen this too, a reluctance of men to ask for help? And if so, what do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I would just add to what Jacob is saying is that shame is a natural driver. People come in their doors to relieve themselves of shame and anxiety. But what we don't talk about enough is grandiosity, where the family or a partner brings the person in kind of mandated way of like, this person needs to change or I'm going to divorce them. Mm-hmm. So often, you know, I see both sides of it, you know, quite probably half my practice is partner related referrals.
And what, you know, is it coming, you think, a lot from just the culture, like what the expectations are for men, that they're just supposed to handle it?
I mean, you know, we are in a patriarchal culture that is internalized, and I think it'll be hard for me not to have this discussion. I'm swimming in that water, so I'm affected by it right now. So, yeah, I think everything affects our internalized patriarchy, everything that's feminine in men. I don't believe this, but I think it's part of the water is weak. It's seen as weakness. So vulnerability is seen as weakness. I don't agree with that, but that's the water we're swimming in.
Tell me more about the water we're swimming in right now, what we're seeing right now in our culture and politics and living through the pandemic. Like, what are you seeing that is really at the core of a lot of men struggling right now?
You know, that I think they're struggling being home, and they're struggling trying to be good fathers. They're struggling trying to figure out how to get a good routine. They're, you know, finding more time to play video games and look at pornography on the internet and, you know, get a lot of bad behaviors back in their life that they didn't want. And so they're just feeling not great about themselves.
And as you talk with them, do you find, is it helpful when they talk with you and find out that they're not alone in the struggle?
I think that always helps, right? Right. Universality, this idea that we're connected and we're not some weirdo. And I think men don't do that enough. And, you know, I talk about my own experience with them just to kind of normalize it. So. Mm.
All right. Well, let's take some phone calls as we talk about men and men's mental health issues. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 in Minneapolis right now. Let's bring Julian into the conversation. Julian, what do you want to tell us?
Yeah, thanks for the time. And I think this is a timely and great conversation. So appreciate you guys having it and the guests. For myself, you know, my experience, you know, with this was not seeing some of the indicators early enough. And I think as people, you know, kind of realize what's going on in their lives, they look back and they say, I could have seen that sooner. And for me, it was just that early indication that you're not totally in control of your own thought. And, you know, the best thing you can do when you notice that is to talk to somebody and share that information with them. So, you know, I think there's the conversation that you guys are having about like what's going on. And then there's the kind of like, what can people really do? And I think it's, what are some of those common early indicators? And, you know, I thought mine, as I shared it, became obvious that other people have had that too. And, you know, for me, eventually getting on a small dose of citalopram helped me, you know, control that. But it was all about finding a place to slow down, realize what was going on, and appreciate that, you know, I wasn't fully in control of my own thoughts. And once I did that, once I, you know, was able to get on a low dose, it felt like those issues or those concerns kind of slid off me in a way that they didn't before I recognized it. And, you know, it started really from talking to people about, you know, what was going on and what I wasn't happy about, and kind of led to realizing that I just wasn't fully in control of where my brain was at.
So, Julian, help me with this. Do you have a diagnosis of anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that. I don't know that I ever got to the point where, you know, someone was giving me a very formal diagnosis versus saying, you know, this is what's going on with you. This might help. You know, and so I guess I couldn't say that it was, I can't remember back to there being a formal diagnosis, mm-hmm. versus just, you know, eventually seeing a psychiatrist and getting some recommendations for how to help manage, you know, where I was at the time of my life.
And in your case, medication helped?
It did for a short time, and it was really just a short-term thing to help mm-hmm. me realize what was going on. And then after that, it became something I was aware of, could appreciate about myself, learned about myself. And, you know, there's times when that can be helpful and times when, you know, I'm able to manage without. And that's something that you do in combination with, you know, your doctor, your community, whoever's helping you kind of understand, you know, your state of health. Right. I think medication doesn't have to be a long-term thing, but it could be something mm-hmm. that helps in the short term, you know, get you back to a good state of mind. Mm-hmm.
Julian, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. We're talking about mental health and men and taking your calls. In St. Paul, James is on the phone. James, what did you want to tell us as we talk about this?
Well, you know, I have had several friends who've had problems, and my father was a practicing psychologist, and one of the big things that I've noticed is that almost invariably when men reach out for help, somebody around them in their support, whether it's family or whatever, starts to treat them with less respect, less autonomy, and less decency in some way, shape, or form, to the point where oftentimes, you know, when they seek advice, part of the advice is don't show your hurt or your anger in your domestic situation, for example, because it will be used against you to keep you out of your children's lives or out of participating fully in the family. So that has a lot to do with why a lot of men are reluctant to participate or to speak out, because it's not like it's a secret what happens when you do reach out.
Mm. All right. That's James in St. Paul. Brett, what do you think about that? What James just shared, that women have made it difficult for some men to reach out for help or openly state they needed help.
Yeah.
Have you heard
I think-
that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of comes down to your environment, and it's like we all need people in our surroundings that like, or just one person even that you can go to, that you know you can call up and go to when you need to vent a little bit, because you bottle it up and, you know, you hold that in too long and you're toast. So I've been lucky in that regard. I've always had like one or two really good friends that are like really willing to call me out on my BS and that kind of thing. So that's always been really, really clutch, because I know how tough it can be for people who are in, like, you know, tough home environments with a, you know, I don't know, an emotionally abusive significant other, where it's just like your barometer for what's real and what's not real just really gets skewed and out of whack. So yeah, I mean, I guess you don't need a ton of friends in the world, but you do need one or two really good, like, go-to buddies.
And Jacob, have you heard some of your clients talk about, well, when they share they need some help, that people that they're close to seem to somehow lose respect for them?
Yes, I definitely have seen that, where in some ways maybe a partner can be at least the initial catalyst. And I know that sometimes for people, and it sounds like the gentleman that called in has had that experience where maybe they're being told and getting messages from people close in their lives that somehow they're bad, they're destructive, maybe there's maybe anger outbursts, and then they go to maybe therapy. And I guess maybe sometimes people might didn't initially experience, yes, we're trying to work on anger, we're talking about an issue, but I hope for more people, and I'd like to think that it happens, is that therapists really aren't, or at least I'm not ever trying to label somebody or categorize somebody as good, bad, or anything, because it's actually usually from maybe some sense of worthlessness, isolation, powerlessness that, and I do think this might be a little bit more true, is where men might be more likely to manifest that as anger. Anger feels more powerful, but I always consider anger a little bit of a secondary symptom to some sort of worthlessness or shame. But then as I've, with some men that I've worked with, as and they're really open to it, is it's more about to me exploring the underlying causes, what's actually happening, and expressing, yes, being angry is totally okay. We all feel it. It in and of itself is not a negative emotion, but it's just maybe how we react, how we express that, that I think is important and can matter. That is sort of can be the thing also, the dangerous spiral of, let's say, anger can spring out of shame or being hurt. Then often with at least some of the men I work with, then after they do have an outburst or an implosion, they then tell me later about how much shame they feel from that. And it is sort of this reinforcing thing. So I do think therapists have to be very careful and gentle and normalizing it, and making sure, again, maybe the relationship does feel safe, a therapeutic one, before starting to dive into, you know, maybe possibly having the client and working with them on confronting possibly what's underneath it. So,
and Ash, what did you hear in what James in St. Paul was saying, you know, that, you know, he felt as though there was a loss of respect in sharing this with his partner?
You know, it comes back to the patriarchy idea. I think, you know, women carry that, all genders carry that, you know, it's hard, it's the water we swim in. And it's so much in our unconscious about how we want people to be, that especially in times of distress, you know, and the civil unrest in our city, I felt like I couldn't be weak. I needed to step up for my family. And I think that's what a lot of men internalize. And I think therapy is just an offshoot of that.
Right. Let's take another phone call before we head into a news break. In St. Paul, I want to talk to Jesus. Good morning to you, Jesus. What did you want to share with us as we talk about men and mental health?
Good morning. Yes. What I'd like to share is that as a person of color who's in his mid-40s, as I navigate the system, I feel like my racial identity also comes across as being somebody who might be aggressive or somebody who demonstrates like the sense of, I don't know, danger. I feel like my sense of humanity is robbed from that. So as I talk to others, or especially when I need assistance, I feel like I'm never given really the opportunity to be seen as a whole person because of that construct of, oh, this person with tattoos. So I never really get the chance to really feel that my emotions could be even a benefit to me, or the display of that sense of, like, I actually am a caring, loving human being. And in that, when I experience those moments, it only like, for instance, the scab of the idea that I can't be emotional. Mm-hmm. And because I can't be emotional, I lie into the idea of my cultural aspect of machismo, which then only takes me further from my own sense of humanity. Mm-hmm. And that's really unfortunate, because I'm not seen as a whole person. I'm only seen under this construct of who I'm supposed to be, which is like an aggressor or someone who's really tough or violent. Yeah.
Mm, Jesus, thank you. Hold on here. I want you to hear from Anesh. Anesh, as a man of color, a therapist of color, what are your thoughts about what Jesus just described, the cultural aspect of this?
I mean, I think that's so right on. I think our identity and is shaped by the world around us. You know, we react so much to how much people react to us. If they like us, if they smile at us, if they walk towards us and don't go across the street when we're walking, all those things shape how we see ourselves. And it's hard not to take on that identity.
And so do you feel that some of your clients who come to you, are they seeking you out because they feel as a therapist of color that the conversation is going to start at a different place?
Yeah, I definitely think that. I think that even my last name, you know, I'm multiracial, so I grew up mostly here, but just having an Asian Indian last name, I think makes Asian Indian people comfortable seeing me.
And Brett, what do you think? Why do you think it's so important for men to open up about their mental health? Like, why? I mean, you've written a book about it. It's part of, you know, how you're living your life talking about this. Why is this so important for men to really open up and talk about their mental health?
Yeah, I mean, well, once I started doing it, I just started to feel way more sane. I mean, I've always loved like depression comedy. You know, Bo Burnham is great at that, Gary Gulman. So that's like my favorite form of comedy. And I know mental health is like can be like a taboo subject and a really sensitive, really serious subject. But to me, like the comedic angle of mental health and like humor around anxiety has always, that's always been like the number one solution for me. I mean, because it is hilarious, like the amount of stuff that we actually do worry about, and like 99% of it is just totally self-inflicted nonsense that we just do it to ourselves. You know, at least I do that consistently. I kind of like live in a toilet bowl of worrying. So yeah, once I started making fun of my own anxieties and like doing illustrations, like with the book, it really just kind of made life a lot easier.
And yeah, this is an illustrated book, I should say, and it's about, you know, breaking the stigma through humor. It's hard to be a person. These illustrations, like, what's the deal with the illustrations in your book?
Yeah, so, I mean, the illustrations kind of started as a bit of a joke 3 years ago. I was just drawing. I've always loved to draw since I was, like, but a wee little man, and I would sit there and draw for 8 hours, but started drawing again in my adult life. And I'll be honest, like my illustrations haven't evolved that much since fifth grade, but it kind of works. You know, it's like meat and potatoes drawings. It's like, I don't know, every page I wanted to make like some useful tip or tactic for like a specific instance of anxiety, like how to stomach self-promotion online, or why Facebook pisses you off, or what to do if... again, someone doesn't reply to your email and you're worried that they hate you. So it's a mishmash of like ham-fisted humor and then like utilitarian, useful, like mental health boosts, you know?
All right. Well, we're going to continue our conversation about men and mental health after we take a news break. We're talking with two therapists here in the Twin Cities who focus on men and men's issues, as well as Brett Newsky, who is a musician and a singer, performing tomorrow night at the 7th Street Entry there at First Avenue in Minneapolis. Brett's written a book called It's Hard to Be a Person, and it's about mental health. And I want to remind you also that tomorrow is Give to the Max Day. So we want you to support the news and information that you rely on with a donation. If you appreciate this conversation, this is part of what we do here at NPR News. We want you to maximize your gift by providing meals for families in need through Second Harvest Heartland. All you have to do is go to nprnews.org, and you can do that now. Give now at nprnews.org. Now back to the conversation about anxiety and depression and other mental health issues facing men. My guests today include musician Brett Newsky, whose new book is called It's Hard to Be a Person. Brett is performing at 7th Street Entry there at First Avenue in Minneapolis tomorrow night. And his book will be there as well, if you want to check that out and learn more about it, buy it. Jacob Shukman Falk is with us, as well as Anish Patel. They're both therapists in the Twin Cities who work with men on men's issues. And we want to hear from you, too. Are you a man who has struggled with your mental health? Have you found help for that? Are you finding healing in some type of creative pursuit? Do you live with or love a man with a mental health struggle? Have you been able to help him with his healing? And if so, how? Do you need some advice? Call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can also message me on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, MPR. All right, let's go to the phone lines right now as lots of listeners are calling in with some questions and stories. In Woodbury, we have Sherry on the phone. Good morning, Sherry. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling because I want to piggyback on what the therapist had talked about with the shame and what we're talking about, men not coming forward with the feelings they're having and how it starts. And what I've experienced is since this year, I'm in counseling now because my husband admitted to 25-year-plus pornography addiction. Mm-hmm. That started as a young child and exposure to that. So what's happened for a lot of men that I've learned in a lot of my counseling is that if they're exposed early, they find this is a way to soothe their anxiety, and that becomes a shameful, vicious cycle, and therefore it increases the shame. It also makes it worse for partners, because if you don't know that's what they're dealing with, they're now living a double life, which then is another way for them to have this self-defense mechanism, which is a mental health issue, because their impaired thinking increases. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, when I realized something is off, he's not sharing his feelings, he's not talking about deeper things, it's because he's trying to hide what he is feeling, because he's had to shut that part of himself off. And then he goes to porn to soothe any anxiety or boredom or any issues he may have that I am, as the partner, not aware of. And so that becomes a really big problem. And what's interesting, when I asked him, you need to go to counseling, something's off, something's not right, he would blame me. So a lot of times in porn addiction, the man will gaslight or blame the partner as the problem. And when I asked him to go to counseling, what's interesting is he said he did go and he saw someone, and he went in with the thinking that as a couple, we have a communication problem. His porn addiction never even came up, never even was brought up. So again, trying to avoid that shame, or trying to not be aware of those feelings, that being able to share that with a spouse. So not only are they not going to talk about feelings, they're not going to seek help if they're so shameful. And that, I think, is one of the big pandemics in this country is porn addiction that people are just not aware of. I've been in counseling with lots of groups, hundreds and hundreds of damaged marriages, wonderful, educated women blindsided by this years later, because there's such a double life and a way that they are able to cope, but so unhealthy, such a mental health issue. And I don't know, Sherry, if the therapists want to address
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I want to give our therapist a chance to talk about this. Sherry, thank you, first of all, for calling in and sharing that with us. And to our therapist, how often, how frequently do you see porn addiction come up in conversation as you're counseling some of your clients? And Sherry is asking also, you know, what about the partners and what can the partners do to be helpful? Jacob?
It's something I've definitely seen more and more of, maybe because I'm 34 as well, so I grew up with initially hearing the dial-up internet, but then grew up with the digital age, not quite the same as I think young adults and teens today would. But pornography, whatever kind of form of kind of coping, it is often that we're often trying to hide from ourselves, hide from others, attack ourselves, attack others, and part of the way we might be able to kind of hide from ourselves is some sort of coping, is kind of escaping. And then unfortunately, kind of as mentioned, is that these things that happen earlier in life that we use to cope or that just help us, you know, whatever, even if it's kind of we would later on consider pretty harmful, they do become patterns often without intention, without disruption, without somebody else stepping in. As children, we just kind of don't necessarily have that same kind of cognitive ability to really kind of maybe take charge, think more abstractly. And so many of these things happen once, but then it's the repeated experience that just basically reinforces. So it is automatic. It becomes something someone's not even aware of. So yeah, someone goes to therapy thinking, yeah, we're just having some communication issues. And then much later it's revealed, oh, this. And then maybe the associated shame, as she was kind of talking about. I do think, and a lot of people do, and it's not the responsibility of somebody else always, but as being, as validating, willing to listen to somebody's feelings, gently encouraging it, finding a language that works for them, that resonates with them, is for anyone the most, to me, beneficial, helpful thing, is to be able to sit with your feelings and not necessarily be afraid of, not run from, be aware of. And that's how then I think you can kind of start to transform and create the changes that someone is looking for. So,
and Anesh, have you found that people are willing to talk about an addiction to pornography and express concerns about how it's affecting their relationships with the people in their lives?
Yeah, I find if I ask about it, definitely comes up, and it's a huge issue. But I think I try not to overly focus on it. I try to focus more on what they're trying to get. If they're trying to get more intimacy in their relationship, mm-hmm. kind of reminding them, if you're at a fancy restaurant and fantasizing about fast food, it's not a really helpful way to enjoy that restaurant. And just trying to keep mm-hmm. them goal focused, trying to keep them focused on their broader values, because it's something, and having empathy, like we've never had this phenomenon in the history of mankind, womankind, and of having all access to everything at any point of time. And so it's trying to figure out how to control that.
And we think about the young age, this early exposure to pornography. Sherry mentioned, you know, it's her understanding that, you know, that it can create even more problems if it's established very early on. Is that true?
I think it's true. I mean, I think you could say that about alcohol. You could say that about marijuana, any other mm-hmm. addictive process. What it does is it makes it so you're not feeling your emotions completely. It stunts growth.
Mm. All right. Let's take another phone call from one of our listeners. Let's talk to Joseph, who's in Minneapolis. Good morning, Joseph. What do you want to share with us as we talk about mental health issues and men?
Yeah. Hi. Hi, Angela. I'm a Minneapolis resident. I started out my life with ADHD and quickly went into developmental post-traumatic stress disorder, which ended up, as I aged, turned into complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And what I wanted to talk about is something that people don't frequently mention, but it's the sheer frustration of something like this, because what happens is you have the initial trauma that sets up the post-traumatic stress disorder, but then anything that happens later on that's remotely traumatic kind of gets added to the list. And it can be something traumatic that happened while you were doing something that you love, and all of a sudden you become avoidant of those things that you love. And it's a very, very hard barrier to break through. Mm. And it's extremely frustrating. Mm. And yes, I've been working with a therapist and I have a PTSD group I go to. So I'm working through this stuff, but it's still enormously difficult.
Oh, avoidance.
Go ahead.
No, you talked about avoidance. So you are avoiding things that normally would make you happy. And so because you have now this loss of it, that makes you unhappy.
Correct. For instance, it's very hard for me to pick up my guitar.
Hmm. All right. Anesh, what would you say to what Joseph has described there?
Just sorry that this happened in the first place. This, you know, the trauma is so debilitating to people, and then to have repeated injuries to that initial wound, it's, you know, trying to get a plant to grow with just throwing more and more rocks on top of it. It's really mm-hmm. difficult. And so I'm glad that you're getting help, and I'm, you know, whatever you could do to keep moving towards trying to find safe places, trying to move towards the things you fear in a slow, methodical way, I think would be helpful.
And Brett, how did that hit you hearing him just say that it's hard for him to pick up his guitar?
Yeah, I certainly feel for you on that one. Yeah. And I just think, It you know, I can't speak specifically to the ADHD, but I do feel like, you know, how hard it is to start things. I think whether it's, you know, picking up the guitar, writing a song, writing an essay, and I often feel like starting things is the hardest part. So I'll try to trick myself into starting projects or starting tasks that maybe I don't want to do. Like, oh, I'll just get up and I'll write for 4 minutes. And then you like force yourself into writing for 4 minutes. And then by the time you're into it, you're like grooving and it feels good. And you're like, oh, sweet, I've been writing for 28 minutes. So Henry Rollins has this great quote that I'm obsessed with. He says, the hardest part about going for a jog is getting out the door. Mm-hmm. And I just find that like so true for just, yeah, starting new things in general or picking up old things, you know.
Let's take another phone call from a listener as we talk about mental health and men in particular in St. Paul. Zach is on the phone. Good morning, Zach.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for talking about this.
Sure. What's going on?
Well, I'm 28, kind of thing. I recently moved into St. Paul, and I recently started taking antidepressants and going to counseling for both anxiety and depression. One thing I did want to say is that, especially around, I feel like in my age, my parents' generation was a lot, talked a lot about more, you know, keeping that kind of stuff in-house, you know, very private. So not necessarily a stigma against mental health stuff, but definitely not talking about it. That combined with a lot of the political atmosphere, climate change, everything along those lines kind of thing, it's very, very easy to say that the anxiety and depression is normal. I'm a good case example because I only started going into counseling after, similar to what we said earlier, of about having a huge amounts of acid reflux, sleep problems kind of thing, pretty much until it got to a crisis level before I actually started going and getting help for it.
And Zach, what do you want people to know who are listening about mental health issues and taking a step to try to get some help?
Just the fact that you need to look, be more introspective and actually ask yourself whether or not this is normal, whether or not this is okay, whether or not you can feel like you can be doing better. And if you're running into a problem, getting to that being better part, then you might want to go into counseling and just ask for some help and just see if this is normal.
All right. Thank you. That's Zach calling in from St. Paul. Also in St. Paul, Missy's on the phone. Missy, we're talking about mental health and men. What do you want to share with us?
So a few years ago, my husband and I started going to counseling, and my counselor was like, you know, I really think you should bring him in because it sounds like maybe there's some control issues going on. So we went a few times, and then we just stopped going because he was like, this is dumb. So, all right, you know, time goes by and the pandemic hits. And, you know, I've just noticed just he goes from like everything's fine to snappish. And so, you know, even the kids even noticed it and were like, you know, why is Dad so grumpy? And so he turns to me a little while ago and he was like, I just feel like everything's dark and I just don't feel like myself. And so, you know I'm struggling with my own stuff, but I'm going to a counselor. But then I'm like, how do you tell someone, look, I think you need to go to the counselor? And he's even said, I think I need to go, but he won't pick up the phone and it makes the appointment himself. And so it's like, I kind of feel like I would gaslight him if I were to say, hey, do you want me to make the appointment for you? But it feels icky. But how do you encourage someone to, I mean, just do it. Just take care of yourself. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know the magic words, but at the same time, I don't know that I'm the one who needs to fix him. And I feel like a jerk wife mm-hmm. for saying that. But
all right, Missy, let's see if we can get you some help. Exact words. Missy is looking for the words. And I guess the question is, how do you encourage someone to take care of themselves? Anesh, any advice?
I think it comes down to just saying, I'm worried about you. I care about you and I want the best for you. And then, you know, starting from that place of positive relationship reinforcement, like, and also leverage, you know, I think a lot of people get to the point where if you don't get help, I might need to separate from you. I think that there's leverage there that sometimes needs to be used.
Mm. There can be consequences. There can be mm-hmm. loss by not mm-hmm. giving it attention. Jacob, any advice for Missy? What are the words to use or for all of us to, if you want to encourage someone to get help for themselves?
Yeah, I definitely would agree with the kind of what Nesh was saying in terms of, to me, it's still about kind of emphasizing that it's coming from a loving place, that you care about them, and that really emphasizing that it's not that they're broken. It's not that they're bad and evil. And that's not what therapy, and ideally that's what the client gets experience, is about. But in some ways, de-trigger or try to emphasize, you know, words that aren't going to possibly reinforce or activate more, whether subconsciously or not, well, you know, maybe something like the world is dark. There is something wrong with me. I don't know who I am. That sometimes can kind of, you know, cause someone to also not do it. The leverage thing definitely happens. It's not, I think, the people usually set out and it's not their first resort. It is just a reality that sometimes, yes, people I see are there because essentially there will be a consequence if they don't. That can be a little bit difficult or different to work with at the beginning. But as kind of just, and it's not meant as a threat, it's not meant as an ultimatum, it's a natural consequence of things. So even if someone does have to say that, if able to kind of frame it that way rather than, you know, we might say it out of a more emotional place of, if you don't do this, then I'm going to leave. That might be emotionally true and valid. But in terms of if you're looking for a way to communicate to somebody, encourage them to go to therapy, the way you word sort of a that, you know, the leverage sort of, or just how you're feeling that I can't be with somebody if you're always angry or whatever it might be, to kind of, you know, just be as careful with that as possible. And that might, like I was saying earlier, include just how much you love them, how much you care. But then if you do have to mention the possible consequence, to just name it as such. So.
All right. In our final few minutes here, I want to take one more phone call in Minneapolis. Mark is on the phone. Mark, what do you want to tell us about mental health in men?
Well, I sure appreciate this conversation. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the power of the group and, mm-hmm. and how one of your panelists earlier mentioned, you know, guys are so alone and guys feel like nobody understands them. And we have found at the organization I run that the peer support group really helps. And men find cover in groups. They can listen. They can learn. They can hear other people's experiences. You know, when somebody else is willing to reveal something they've carried around that maybe that other man feels shame about, it can take some of that sting away from that guy acknowledging that, you know, for himself. And that act of going to therapy, look, men don't seek help for physical health issues. And that act of going to therapy is a really challenging big step. And as I've heard many of your women callers say, there's this behavior a man is engaged in that they want him to get help for. And he's now intimidated. He's afraid. He's, you know, feeling more shame. And so it, you know, it's a big first step for people to take. And I believe very strongly that the more we can get other men talking about these issues in group sort of settings, it's very powerful. It's very powerful.
Mark, thank you. And Brett, in just our last minute here, you're a singer, a writer. You're good with words. Give us some advice to the men out there who are listening, who are looking for some support, some help.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I really think, like, creativity is the best free, quick therapy out there. You know, it's easier to do than going drive into a place and seeing somebody. Obviously, that's really great to do. Mm-hmm. But everyone's a creative person, and it just bums me out so much when people say, like, oh, you know, I'm not creative at all. It's like, even something as simple as like drawing a dinosaur on a napkin. I mean, it sounds dumb, but honestly, like if you create something that wasn't in the world, that didn't exist before, it's
that
a pretty sweet feeling. And
right.
Even if you're not releasing, you know, arts projects or creative creations to show the world, you don't have to show people. You can just make it for yourself. And it's just a great vent. Yeah.
Well, Brett, we're out of time, but I want to let people know again, your book is called It's Hard to Be a Person. That is Brett Newsky. He is performing at the 7th Street Entry at First Avenue in Minneapolis on Thursday night. Also, our thanks to our two therapists here in the Twin Cities, Jacob Shukman Falk and Anesh Patel. Thank you, guys. This conversation today was produced by our senior producer, Susan Davis. Be safe, everyone, and we'll talk again tomorrow morning at 9. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.